everybody. Welcome to the Psychology of Video Games podcast. My name is Jamie Madigan, and I have made it my mission in life to help people understand the intersection of psychology and video games, how psychology can be used to make better games, to understand games, and to understand what happens to players when they play games. In every episode of this podcast, I interview an expert on the intersection of psychology and games about a particular topic. This is the episode about the difficulties of doing good research on psychology and video games. I feel I should also mention that there's a website, psychologyofgames.com, and at that website you can find literally hundreds of other articles that I've written and published about the psychology of video games, as well as dozens of episodes of the podcast. You can also find information on how to subscribe to the website and the podcast, and how to contact me and follow me on various social media. You should go check it out. So, back when I started doing this whole psychology of games thing, back in 2009, I think it was, I wasn't really aware of a lot of scientific, peer-reviewed, high-quality research on the topic. Turns out there was a fair amount of it kicking around, for sure, and I've found out about it since. But it's kind of amazing how much this kind of research has exploded in the last few years. One informal analysis by Patrick O'Connor over at comicspedia.blogspot.com found a 274% increase in peer-reviewed studies about psychology in video games. That's in the last six or so years relative to the early 2000s. It's amazing and it's kind of awesome. And yet, this kind of research is hard to do. More so, I think, than research on certain basic cognitive functions or even more applied research like consumer behavior or decision-making. Video games are rich experiences that people generally engage in for hours at a time across a variety of different situations. And there are many different kinds of games that vary widely in their mechanics, their demands on the player, the type of technology that they rely on, and the effects they can be expected to have on players. Studying a PC simulation game and trying to generalize your findings to a mobile phone game or a shooter played in a virtual reality headset is tricky at best and foolhardy at worst. And yet, some researchers try to do exactly that. Two areas where this kind of thing show up a lot are studies on violent video games and studies on addiction, sometimes called problematic gameplay. Not coincidentally, these are two of the biggest and frequently two of the most controversial topics among video game researchers. Some critics of this research argue that we haven't even really done the most basic of work in operationalizing our terms and widely agreeing on what we mean by them. What do we mean by aggression, for example, or addiction? And when research is done on these topics, the methodologies used are sometimes not adequate to rule out all kinds of confounding variables and alternate explanations for the results. It's tempting to say that this is just bad research or lazy researchers, but I think that totally misses the earlier point that this kind of thing is hard to do because of the nature of games and gaming experiences. That makes it no less an important topic to study, though, and it's useful to look at the limitations of the research to try to chart a path forward. That's what I'm going to do with this week's podcast guest. In particular, we're going to talk about the trickiness of studying aggression in the laboratory.
There's no fear of being reprimanded for it. There's no social disapproval by others. So all of these contingencies that we usually have, that usually govern whether we are behaving aggressively or not, all of these contingencies, they don't exist in the laboratory.
And when it doesn't even make sense to talk about addiction in games, and when it might.
And that's actually the reason why gambling has made it, in a way, to the diagnostic manuals that we have. Because the harm that it causes is enormous. If gambling wasn't about money, gambling was about time, maybe there wasn't any money involved, I don't think we would be talking about it. I don't think that diagnosis would exist. We have acknowledged that it's a problem and that those people need treatment because they're hurting themselves, they're hurting others. And the same cannot be said for video games.
And after all of that, what might you want to do if you're interested in getting into studying this whole psychology of video games thing? How can you get ready for it? How can you prepare? That's coming up in just a minute. This episode of the Psychology of Games podcast is supported by, well, nobody specific. I don't really have ads on here. But what I do have is a Patreon page where you can go and help make sure that there are future episodes of the podcast by kicking a buck or two my way. It's super easy to set up. Couldn't be easier, I swear. And there are some neat rewards for Patreon supporters. Plus, as I hit funding goals, I'll release extra content for you to enjoy. Just go to patreon.com/POG. That's for Psychology of Games, obviously. Patreon.com/POG. All right, let's move on to the interview. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us on the interview portion of the podcast. This episode, I have Malt Elson, who is a researcher, does a lot of research related to video games, and is here to talk to us about some of the realities of doing research on entertainment products, especially video games, and how you balance the need for scientific rigor with the realities of that kind of research and trying to answer the questions that are important to that topic. So, Malt, welcome. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Hey, thank you for inviting me to your podcast. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Great. So, who are you and what are you doing here?
Right. Well, as you said, I'm a researcher. So I'm a postdoctoral researcher at Ruhr University of Bochum in Germany. I work in the Educational Psychology Research Group. My research is mostly about video games psychological research methods and psychological knowledge production in a way. So how do psychologists do research? How do they do science? How do they evaluate science? These are my two broad research topics.
You know, we talked a little bit offline about the concept of doing good research about video games is tricky, from what mm-hmm. I understand. And I've talked to a lot of researchers, and they say that in good research, or at least in straightforward research, it's a lot of times you would do something like you would have two or more groups, and you would have different treatments for those groups. And so you would isolate the only difference between these groups is the thing that I'm interested in studying the effects of it. And so I would have one group would be the control group that I wouldn't do anything. And then I'd have one or more experimental groups. You know, this is research methods 101 type of stuff.
Right.
But then that's difficult to do in the context of video games from what I understand, because it's sometimes difficult to have two different groups play two different video games, or one group play a game and one group not. And games are such complex experiences that it's difficult to pin down like what the effect is, or what exactly the treatment is you're getting, or be able to say with confidence, like, this group was different than the other group because of the thing that I did. So can you just kind of walk us through that type of situation that a lot of researchers encounter?
Right. So the logic of any scientific experiment, not just in psychology, but in all sciences, is that you manipulate a factor of interest to you. And in the case of video game research, that's, for example, often the displays of violence, for example. And so that's your experimental factor that you manipulate. And then you have your outcome measure. That's the target variable that you think your manipulation is going to have an effect on. So it's a fairly simple equation. On the one hand, you have this experimental factor, and on the other hand, or the predictor in a way, and on the other hand, you have the outcome variable. So, and as you already suggested, with video games, it's not that easy, because video games themselves are a quite complex stimulus. Like in basic cognitive psychology, sometimes your stimuli are just words. And that's fairly easy to manipulate, because, words can consist of multiple letters. But other than that, that's it, right? They're pretty flat, and a pretty simple stimuli. But of course, video games are complex, not just visually, but they also have sounds. They have mechanics, they have a story, and all of that. And that is that can bring video game researchers into trouble. So early on, when video games research, particularly effects research, started, which is like 25 years ago, researchers did basically what you also said. They would have had two groups. One group plays a video game that has that features the type of rival they're interested in. So, for example, they play a violent video game, and then the other group just does nothing. They don't do anything.
They like literally sit there for 15 minutes or whatever. Yeah,
listen to some relaxing music or
right.
something that is not really demanding or challenging or anything like that. They would just do nothing, and then researchers pretty quickly figured out that that might not be the right way to go about it, because although of course the one group that your experimental group is exposed to the content that you're interested in, they're also exposed to a lot of other things that might or might not influence your target rival. So for example, people play a violent video game, and let's say it's a competitive one, which most of the violent video games are, and they lose the game. They are exposed to the violent content, but they're also exposed to a maybe frustrating experience. Well, the other group just does nothing, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that of course posed a bit of a problem to researchers. So they went on and tried to give the other group, the control group, another game to play. And they were trying to match those games as good as possible. So have two different games, one violent, for example, and the other non-violent, but make sure they're about the same level of excitement. They have the same difficulty. Maybe they have the same type of graphics quality, the same level of immersion or narrative complexity. And as you can already see, there are a lot of variables you would need to control for. You would need to make sure that those games are at least somewhat comparable to each other. At one point, you can come up with a long list of things that you say might be important, so those games should be fairly similar on. And that basically sort of only shifted the problem. The essential problem from before stayed the same. One group would be exposed to the type of contents researchers are interested in, but also to many things the other group wouldn't be exposed to. So in a way, when you have one group play a violent video game, let's say they play let's pick a classic example, Counter-Strike, and the other group plays Tetris. And you compare those two groups for the outcome variable. So after playing, you measure some, let's say, aggressive behavior,
right.
For example. You don't really know what of those differences between the games caused differences in the outcome variable, which is a basic problem for all experimental scientists, which is the problem of experimental control or stimulus control. That, of course, is a problem if you're interested in studying a very specific research question, a very specific content effect.
The example that always comes to mind for me is very similar to what you described. I had Andy Shabilsky on the podcast a while ago, and he and some co-authors did a really interesting study along those lines where they said, you know, there's been some research that shows that playing violent video games causes people to display, you know, quote unquote, aggressive behaviors, and there's like a whole debate about whether those behaviors were truly aggressive or not, but they caused them to engage in certain behaviors or to go into certain mindsets, psychological states. And their hypothesis was that, you know, you can't have somebody play like a first person shooter and compare that person to a game, somebody playing Tetris, because in Tetris, you just got like four buttons or like, you know, a directional pad and a button. Whereas a first-person shooter, like, you have an entire keyboard, potentially, and it's much more complex, and it's harder. And their hypothesis was that, hey, the difference between these two groups, or the relevant difference, isn't violent content or exposure to violent content. It's that the controls are frustrating and difficult. And, and they did some cool studies where they manipulated that, and they rigged up like a game of Tetris to be very difficult and frustrating to control, and they found effects that they expected. And so, like, hey, we thought that it was violence or exposure to violent content and images, but really what it is that you're thwarting these people's ability to be good at the game, and you're frustrating them.
Right. Yeah, Andy's and my work is quite similar in that regard. We both try to manipulate games in a way that, you know, maintains most or yeah, ideally all of the factors constant across the two groups in your study, except the one factor you're interested in. And exactly as you described, Andy's study, they did some interesting manipulations of the controls. Mm-hmm. We manipulated first person shooters. In one study, we manipulated Unreal Tournament, and in another, we used Team Fortress 2. And we tried to create a non-violent version of the game. So we were able to manipulate that factor and other factors that we thought were interesting.
So how did you turn something like Team Fortress 2 into a non-violent game?
Yeah. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Rainbow Blower. In Team Fortress 2,
it's one of the pyro weapons, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a weapon that comes with the game, and the pyro basically has a trumpet, that fires rainbows instead of fire.
Yeah, it's kind of a joke, but it sounds like you're making better use of it here. Go ahead.
Yeah. It was a surprising opportunity, because before that we had to do those kinds of manipulations ourselves. Like, we had to mod games with the modding tools available, but in that scenario we were able to use something made by the developers of the game, which was obviously of high quality, or equal quality to the violent version. Mm-hmm. Because professional game designers made it for us, and yeah, we used that weapon, and we basically disabled all other weapons in the game, so people were forced to use the Rainbow Blower in one condition and forced to use the regular flamethrower in the other condition. That worked pretty well, because one of the effects of the Rainbow Blower is then when you kill someone, they don't actually die. They fall to the ground laughing.
Right.
There's never any type of death animation, you could say. So with a very simple tool made available to us by the developer, we were able to create a lot less violent version of Team Fortress 2 than the original. And then the other variable we manipulated was difficulty. So we, in kind of in a similar vein as Andy, we were also interested in whether higher levels of difficulty might be causing players to feel frustrated and to increase feelings of anger in them. Mm-hmm. So we just in one condition the opponents had very low health points, and in the other condition they had quite high health points, so it was harder to kill them. Mm-hmm. The more difficult condition. That is how we try to go about the manipulation of these experimental factors that we are interested in. I think it's a lot cleaner way of studying variables interesting to us.
So what did you find in those studies?
Yeah, so in those studies we found no effect at all, no difference at all in terms of aggressive behavior. So the groups were not, or the players were not influenced either by the displayed levels of violence or the difficulty. They had some, they definitely reported stronger feelings of frustration. And quite interestingly, we also found that, depending on the skills of the player, they much, much more enjoyed the more difficult version than the easy version, which is also, I guess, fairly obvious to most players. Most players don't play games on the easiest level to them. They play most games on a level that is challenging to them, but still doable in a way. So that wasn't really surprising to us, but it was surprising to see that neither of the variables had any influence on the aggression measurements, which we haven't talked about yet, but which is another big problem in that type of effects research. How do you measure aggression? How do you find out whether you know, manipulation did have an impact on players or not.
Yeah, so let's talk about what are some of the issues and problems and challenges that have to be dealt with there.
Yeah, so as you can imagine, you can't literally have people beat each other up in a laboratory. For ethical and legal reasons, you need to make sure that nobody actually is harmed, including the players themselves. Like you wouldn't even be allowed to give them the opportunity to destroy an object because there would be a risk that they harm themselves while doing so.
Right. Ethics. Yeah.
Yeah. Ethics and also the law, in a way. Sure. You're responsible for the people that come into your lab.
Those two topics often intertwined. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, sometimes, so the researchers, I mean, this is a big limitation up front to anybody that wants to study aggression in the lab. Researchers try to be very creative about this and come up with scenarios that might be interpreted as aggression, mm-hmm. but don't really have these legal or ethical issues to them. So one very popular instrument to measure aggressive behavior is the so-called competitive reaction time task. It's designed as another simple game. So your study participants are being told that after playing the first video game, they're going to play another much simpler video game where they compete against someone else in a reaction time game. So basically they see some sort of signal, and they have to press button as quickly as possible. And then in each round of that game, the winner gets to punish the loser with a noise blast. And they can set the intensity of that noise blast, so the volume and the duration. And some researchers believe that these noise settings are a proper measure of aggressive behavior. So the louder and longer the noise is the winner sets for the loser, the more aggressive they are thought to be.
Right. So it's like an unpleasant noise, like a honking sound or...
Honking or somebody scratching over a blackboard with their fingernails. Like they're unpleasant, yeah. Definitely. But as anybody can see, it's not really the type of aggression that people are worried about with regards to video games.
Right. They're more worried about getting in a fist fight or saying something hurtful or any of that type of stuff.
Yeah, like sitting in a very safe environment like a university laboratory and sending an unknown stranger in the next room unpleasant noise blasts. It's not something we usually worry about.
Well, and not only that, but you have like the experimenter or the person running the experiment are giving you explicit permission to administer that noise blast, right?
Yeah. So there's absolutely no fear of being reprimanded for it. There's no social disapproval by others. So all of these contingencies that we usually have that usually govern whether we are behaving aggressively or not. Like, for example, our parents being disappointed in us when we get into a fight with someone, or peers holding us back, maybe calming us down. All of these contingencies, they don't exist in the laboratory, naturally, because it's a very artificial situation. But that, of course, again, causes a problem for the researcher, because we want our research to be generalizable to the real world. We want to study something in the laboratory, but still learn something about about real life. This is, I would probably say, the biggest challenge in the research on video games and aggression, that nobody so far has come up with a scenario or procedure that would allow us to do that.
Right. Yeah, I've seen people get really creative. Like, it's, you know, a measure of aggression is how much hot sauce you add to somebody's food, or
how many needles they stuck into a voodoo doll. Right. It's another measure. And you know, these types of procedures sound ridiculous. Like, whether I talk to other researchers or to lay audiences, everybody has to laugh when I tell them about these procedures. But this is what's happening in psychological laboratories. where aggression is being studied. This is not some like small part of the research. This is the lion's share. This is the biggest part of the research is experimental laboratory research. So all of these reviews, all of these meta-analyses, all of these calls for policy change, they are based on this research.
Right.
Mostly based on this research.
And I guess the same criticism holds for the research that looks at psychological states like, oh, you recognized a word related to aggression more quickly than other types of words, for example,
right.
which
right.
then the researchers would might argue that that means that you're thinking about aggression or you're in an aggression,
right.
an aggressive state, aggressive psychological state.
Right. So aggressive behavior is what most people are worried about. But then researchers also study other aspects of aggression, like aggressive feelings or aggressive thoughts are believed to be important in the development of aggression. And of course, how do you measure thoughts? I mean, behavior at least can be observed. People can look at a behavior somebody's exhibiting and make a judgment. Is that behavior aggressive or not? This is something people can observe and people and can study by looking at the person, but thoughts and feelings cannot be studied that way, which makes it even harder in a way to study them. So again, researchers get very creative and come up with procedures that they think tell us something about what's going on inside video game players, basically. So as you described, for example, they will show them a series of words. And basically the idea is, and some of these words have something to do with aggression or violence. For example, the word gun or the word punch or the word kill. And then other words have nothing to do with that. They are similar, like phonetically similar. For example, the word kiss is very similar to the word kill when written on the screen. And then the idea is that if players are faster at detecting, at reading the word kill than the word kiss, they the aggressive thoughts are more accessible to them.
Right. Or at least that's how the argument goes, right?
That's the argument. That's the argument. That's the reason why they study it. But in essence, it's not very surprising that someone who literally just witnessed killing on a screen for the last 15 minutes will have those concepts more accessible to them. Anything else, like if people were thinking about flowers after playing such video games, we would probably think that's pretty strange. We would probably think that something is wrong with that person neurologically, because I mean, why were they not thinking about the stuff they just saw and did, right? So
is that psychological priming? Is that the concept there?
Yeah, that is it comes from the tradition of psychological priming, exactly, which has been under fire in recent years in psychology overall, video games research is no exception to that.
So are there other concepts that have similar problems? I don't know about you, but one of the most frequent questions I get when somebody learns that, like, I write about psychology in video games is those games are so addictive. Like, there's problems with addiction, and I don't want my kid to become addicted, or I don't want to become addicted. Right. Are there similar issues there?
There are similar issues, although they are, of course, somewhat different, because I hope most researchers would agree that you can't study addiction in the laboratory, that addiction is some kind of longitudinal process that needs to develop over time. So at least in a way, there's not that kind of silly lab research that people think generalizes to the real world. But there are other issues. There are conceptual issues. What does it mean to be addicted to video games? Some researchers think it's sufficient that you play a lot. Like somebody who plays 8 hours a day, they would probably say that person's clearly addicted to video games.
Right.
Well, of course, if I have 8 hours a day to spend, I can choose freely. I can pretty much choose freely how I want to spend them. If it's 8 hours of playing video games, and there are no other functional problems, like if I'm still eating and showering and have social contacts and
going
and go
to work,
work
or school, yeah,
whatever, then there's not really an issue here, right? So in some way, there's the problem that we're not very good at defining the kind of functional impairments that video games would have to cause to classify someone as addicted versus just enthusiastic about video games.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's other issues, which also have to do with the measurement of addiction. Researchers come up basically, like each study on addiction has their own measurement for addiction. They all come up with their own questionnaire, their own survey instrument to classify someone. It's not only the problem that they have their own criteria. They also develop new items constantly, new questions, new instruments to test for addiction. And these instruments are quite different from each other. And comparing that to clinical research on addiction to substances or gambling, for example, the differences become quite apparent, because in those areas, most researchers try to agree on a measure to use. They try to find a consensus. Okay, this is the best measure that we have.
Right.
We're all going to use it now. There might be a better one a few years ahead, but for now, this is our gold standard. This is what we use to classify someone as addicted because we all agree that this is probably the best that we have available to us right now. And in video game addiction research, this is just not the case. People are still tinkering. Even individual research groups change their measure from one study to another. So in a way, it is very difficult to compare all those studies to each other because they might be testing for quite different aspects of something that could be called video game addiction.
Are there not like similar contexts where addiction is studied that video game researchers could just lift that stuff? Like people addicted to, like you said, gambling or television or any other kind of leisure activity, or even like workaholics and people addicted to their work and that sort of stuff. It seems like it would be relatively straightforward to adapt those measures, items, scales.
For other media, the same problem exists. There's no defined concept of television addiction, right? Of the few things that are recognized as a diagnosis that are behavioral addictions, I guess gambling would be the closest to video game, to video games, right? But there aren't that many behavioral addictions recognized as psychological problems. Like the idea of something as video game addiction or television addiction is very much pop culture or very, very much everyday. Like my parents would probably say you're addicted to the television, but only very few psychologists or psychiatrists would ever use that term, because addiction is a very serious condition that needs to meet some kind of lowest standard to be recognized as an actual diagnosis that impairs or harms a person in real life. So the reason why gambling, for example, is recognized as a psychological condition is that the harm it causes is quite substantial, not only to the person itself, but also to that person's entire environment. Because most gamblers, unless they have unlimited funds, will ask their family and their friends and others for money. So the harm that they cause can be quite enormous. They will probably also neglect their own family if they have,
and measurable too, right? Like you can.
Yeah, you can see when somebody has a huge debt and is not able to pay it back. And that's actually the reason why gambling has made it in a way to the diagnostic manuals that we have, because the harm that it causes is enormous. If gambling wasn't about money, if gambling was about time, maybe there wasn't any money involved, I don't think we would be talking about it. I don't think that diagnosis would exist. It exists because we have acknowledged that it's a problem and that those people need treatment because they're hurting themselves, they're hurting others in ways that are undesirable. And the same cannot be said for video games. Somebody, like, in extreme cases, of course, it can. Like, let's say someone with a family that completely neglects their partner or their kids to play a video game. That would be worrying, definitely worrying. But this is not, like, this is not what usually is meant when we talk about video game addiction. We mean someone who plays a lot. We mean someone who spends a lot of time with the medium. Maybe even someone who will not always do their homework and sometimes forget about social obligations. But this is something entirely different from the problems caused by someone that is actually addicted to gambling, much less to any substance abuses, mm-hmm. which is a whole another area, obviously.
So is it just the case that we have the wrong label, that we're using the wrong word, and instead of addiction, we should be studying like engagement or motivation to keep playing or something along those lines?
I don't want to say that studying video game addiction is not a legit research area. Researchers can be worried about the problem, and maybe they I also know people who work in practice, who work with adolescents and young adults that exhibit problems related to video games. So there's something there. The question is there something specific to video games that would justify making it its own psychological condition, or is extreme excessive use of video games is just a symptom of something else that we already have as a diagnosis, right? This is something that where I would love to see more research, comorbidity. So are people that we would now maybe classify as addicted to video games according to some instruments that we have, are they also exhibiting other symptoms that we can measure with more reliable tools, like, for example, social anxieties or depression, conditions that are mm-hmm. quite common, in fact. And this is an area where I would see a better future for this topic. I don't think, I haven't seen a good argument what is special about video games in the way similar to what is special about gambling or special about what other behavioral problems that would justify making it its own category and not just a symptom or something that is underlying the problem, in fact.
Yeah, it sounds complex and I guess still developing. People are still figuring it out.
I mean, one interesting part is in a lot of that research we are still lacking longitudinal studies. But of those longitudinal studies we have, it's very apparent that someone that according to a diagnostic instrument used in that study would be classified as addicted. If you measure that same, if you take that same person 6 months later and use that same measure, often it will be the case that a person diagnosed, in quotation marks, at point A would no longer be diagnosed at point B and vice versa. So there seems to be there's a bit of an instability in the diagnosis, which is uncommon for any other psychological condition.
Or unreliability, maybe in a more technical sense.
Yeah, in a way. But the problem is not the unreliability of the measure, is that the criteria that we use to diagnose someone can easily change. They are flexible. So, for example, let's take somebody who plays 8 hours a day in summer break, right? School is over or the university is closed. They have nothing to do. They will play maybe 8 hours a day. A new game comes out.
Yeah.
They're going to play the shit out of that game. And then 6 months later, maybe that's when exams are happening, right? So people are studying. They're no longer playing every day. Maybe they're playing not at all. Maybe they're playing just on the weekends. But someone who's able to do that, somebody who's able to play in times when they just have the resources to do it and regulate themselves in other times, that person is clearly not addicted. That person might be playing excessively or unusually often, but that person is not addicted. They're able to regulate themselves in that way. And this type of variance within a person is something that is that I would say would be quite unusual for a clinical diagnosis. And this is also suggesting that whatever we think is a good definition of video game addiction might not work out.
Right. It sort of argues for a trait versus state definition, where, you know, if circumstances are right, then they go into a state, you know, where they're playing excessively and so forth. But it's not necessarily something inherent. It's not necessarily a trait of that person that they are prone to addiction to these games.
Right. Exactly.
Or maybe it is, and both the situation and the trait interact with each other, or moderate one moderates the other.
Sure. But if it's literally a state, if it's all according to the situation, if it's all happening because it's possible, because the resources are there, because there are no other obligations, then that person doesn't have a problem, you know, to me. Like, unless that person has, unless, I mean, they're neglecting their social life, et cetera, et cetera. But if people are just playing when they have a lot of time on their hands anyway, what are we talking about?
So, you know, we talked about the fact that you need to have good study designs. You need to have good conceptualizations of your outcomes and your, all of your variables and things that you're measuring. How do you sort of take the next step to communicate the research that's done to the world outside of the lab? You know, one of my graduate school advisors, like, one of their favorite sayings was that research is not complete until it's communicated to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So how do people doing research on games and related topics, like, how do they move that from the lab to the larger social context?
Yeah, that is a big concern in video games research, because you have a lot of alarmist statements made publicly, a lot of insinuations or suggestions that video games, that there's scientific evidence that video games might be contributing to violent crime, to shootings, for example. There might be a driving cause in such extreme behaviors, which again is based on very simple, very abstract laboratory research. And that is something we have seen for a long time. Researchers engaging in what is basically a moral panic, they are contributing to a public image of the research on video games that is just not accurate. Like, I'm not saying that video games might not be a cause in aggression. We don't have evidence. Well, we don't have a lot of evidence to the contrary as well. But the evidence that says so is very thin as well. So if we're talking about the science of it, the fair characterization would be that we don't know, but it doesn't look like it's a big issue.
Is not a very interesting newspaper headline.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it also doesn't help you if you need grant proposals, right?
Exactly.
If you need grant money. No,
right.
Of course. I mean, researchers have invested their careers in that topic, and coming up now and saying, well, maybe we wasted, or I'm not saying wasted, but maybe took an extreme position in the last year, in the last 30 years, that wasn't justified by data. This is something, if somebody would do it, it would be admirable, of course, because that's what we expect of scientists. We expect that scientists correct their belief according to scientific data.
That's part of the scientific process, right?
Yeah, right. So but this is just not happening. We have camps that are entrenched and that are fighting with each other and that have been fighting with each other for the past, I don't know, 15 years or so, maybe even longer.
And it's not just the aggression question either. You see headlines about research saying like, oh, kids that play video games don't do as well in school, or they don't do as well socially, all those types of things. And that, there does seem to be a lot of headlines targeted at kids, and maybe that's just because that's what we react to, you know, and what we click through on. But yeah, there does seem to be a lot of that going on. But so how can people like yourself and other researchers sort of get involved and temper those types of inappropriate reactions? Or am I asking too much?
No, but I mean,
or is that even your job?
The answer is very simple. You know, just be honest to the public about the state of the art. But of course, that's an advice that's an advice that some aren't following anyway. Telling them again on your show won't change that, right? So scientists are expected to inform the public accurately about the state of the research. Mm-hmm. As long as we do that, it's fine. But engaging in hyperbole, as researchers have done for quite a while, media in general, and particularly about video games, is just not helping anyone. And if you're, I mean, the thing is, I'm not even sure, or I actually don't think there's any ill intent behind it. I think most of the researchers that are worried about the effects of video games want to make the world better. But somewhere on that way, they lost track of the impact, the potential negative impact video games can possibly have on the world. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I hope and I'm actually quite confident this will change. I see a lot of young researchers doing it much better, doing it much more accurate, even though they might personally believe that playing video games is harmful. And maybe they even have data that suggests so, but they're much more conservative in communicating that to peers and to the public. Right. And if we have reached a point where we can talk about research like adults again, I'm actually quite happy. I'm perfectly fine discussing the possibility of harmful video game effects with somebody. But I don't like to be called a creationist for doubting that this might be the case, right?
So are there any ideas or assumptions about the psychology of video games you think we just need to completely get rid of or start over from scratch in evaluating them?
Yeah. Video games are first and foremost a toy. They're a digital toy. Mm-hmm. And we don't have these kind of worries about other toys. I mean, even toys that kind of look martial, I guess, that feature guns and all of that stuff. Parents aren't usually worried about that stuff. They might not like it. They might not want their kids to play with or to play cowboy, for example. Mm-hmm. But there's no public debate about playing cowboy for Halloween.
Or sports like football or soccer or any of those types of things. Yeah.
And what we need to be clear on is that video games are a digital toy. And there might be, I'm not saying that they're necessarily harmless because of that, but this is the basic premise. You have a digital toy, and then you can start looking at whether it might be different from other toys. It might have some effects that we don't want, that we wouldn't want in society, or that it might facilitate some of them. For example, a research line that I very much think or shows us that there are things we need to worry about video games is the type of language video game players use in multiplayer games, right? There are a lot of racist or sexist comments and behaviors in those multiplayer platforms, and this is something that I'm definitely worried about. But this is not specific to video games. People are just assholes anywhere. But of course, video
I've
games.
Seen it. Yep.
Yeah. So, and I guess everybody has seen it. Everybody has met somebody online that was a dick. But this is not caused by video games. It's just that video games allow it.
Right.
Or very easily to to behave that way. And this is something I can see people being worried about. But if we're talking about a simple stimulus response model, so people playing a game using a digital toy and therefore showing extreme types of responses, like acting aggressively, acting violently, this is something we need to get rid of. This idea that a simple stimulus like a game could fundamentally change human nature and all of the other influences that we are under every day, right? I mean, even assuming that games might have something like a harmful effect, a negative effect driving you towards acting aggressively, what about all the other influences that usually prevent you from doing so? Like, mm-hmm. Let's imagine I'm a 10-year-old boy and I'm starting out acting more and more aggressively because of video games. What about my parents? What about my peers? Aren't they going to do something about it? Right? I mean, those other influences are also there, and they're usually pretty good at intervening with that kind of stuff. And if they're not, if nothing happens, if there's no intervention, if nobody notices I'm behaving differently, then maybe that's where the actual problem lies.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good point that there are lots of factors that push back against aggressive or violent behavior. Yeah. And the things that prevent you and understanding that there will be consequences that are not present in the laboratory study that you maybe just got out of half hour ago. This seems to be a point that's overlooked a lot.
Yeah.
I get maybe once every week or two, I get an email from somebody who says like, hey, I'm an undergraduate student at such and such university, and I think this idea of studying psychology and video games is totally awesome, and I want to do that. And, you know, and they ask like, how do I do that? You know, like, what can I do? And it occurs to me that you may be in some ways a better person to answer this question. So I'll toss it over to you. Like, what advice do you have for students who want a career studying video games in a scientific or academic context? Like, what should they be doing as students or, you know, early on to help them land a job doing that and in order to do it well once they start?
I mean, I only have obvious answers. Read as much as you can.
Yeah.
Read all of the things that you find interesting about video games. And I don't mean read Wired and read Kotaku. I mean, read scientific research and ask yourself whether this is what you want to do for the rest of your life. Basically, video games is a relatively young, video games research is a relatively young field, but there are many branches. You can do more of the psychological effects research that I'm doing, but there are many, many different branches that exist in the humanities, of course, people doing research on video games as an art form, mm-hmm. or as a cultural artifact, which has nothing to do with games. So there are many different branches, and the idea of studying video games as a whole is usually beyond human capacity.
So you got to specialize, huh?
Well, you need to, I mean, need some kind of, you know, basic research question that underlies all of what you do. Mm-hmm. If your research question is, I want to know how people understand video games, I don't think this is going to lead you anywhere, because it's a way too broad question, to ask. So, but then again, reading the literature that is available, it can help you in shaping a much more nuanced question that you have. Mm-hmm. And then you find out whether somebody else has answered it, and if not, do it. You can do it. Get in touch. The good thing about video games researchers is that many of them are young and open, and you can... I only know very few researchers that would be offended by a young person reaching out to them and telling them they want to study video games.
Yeah. Yeah, most of the ones I've encountered seem pretty open to it as well.
Yeah.
And if you're young, you want to publish, you want to do research, you want to, you know, build your career. So
yeah.
any opportunity is a good opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. But also, in a way, I kind of regret that I started doing it. Now, looking back, I kind of feel like I could have done something that is meaningful, more meaningful than what I have done in the past. It's kind of hard to describe because, as I just said, video games are primarily a toy. So what do? We study toys. That's not really helping anyone, right? I mean, it might indirectly, eventually, at one point. But, of course, there are much more urgent questions to be answered. And in a way, I feel like I was definitely driven towards video games research because I like video games personally. And I thought that it would be a good idea to combine these personal interests with a career. Mm-hmm. And now looking back, I'm thinking that if I could reconsider that decision, I might actually have studied something else.
Yeah. I mean, I get what you're saying. You're not learning how to cure a disease or increase, the wealth or the happiness of somebody or doing research that helps people learn new skills or be better people or some of that. But I don't know. I wouldn't sell yourself too short. I think as a field, understanding the psychological roots of games helps make better games and have better gaming experiences. And games are as important as any other form of expression and pastime, and they make people happy. And if you can figure out how to make them so that they can serve other purposes like education or, gamifying experiences to get people more involved in the political process, for example. There's a lot of avenues that you can do pretty meaningful.
Sure. I
don't mean to tell you you're wrong or anything. But
No. But
I'm glad you're doing what you're doing.
You're absolutely right that it's that you can definitely apply a lot of ideas that originate from games to other areas in life. That is definitely true. I didn't mean to say that people should stop studying video games.
I
myself see a lot of young people, a lot of undergrads being excited about the idea of studying something they love personally very, very much, that they spend a lot of time with. But this is not a very good motivator to have a, long-term sustainable career. I think.
You see a lot of people say that about making games as well. I want to be a game designer. I want to make games. And it's like, okay, well, then you need to learn how to code or do create art or do project management or, any of these direct skills. And I can see a parallel there with people saying, like, I want to understand games. I want to study games. It's like, okay, well, you need to learn research methods, data manipulation and statistics and all these other things that like, man, that's boring. All I want to do is like talk about games. It's like, well, it doesn't work that way.
It is boring, but the amazing thing is once you have learned that stuff, you also realize that you could answer a lot more interesting questions with it than understanding video games. Or I don't want to say more interesting, but there the your horizon of possible subjects to study with those tools that you acquired just gets larger and larger.
Yeah, and there are plenty of researchers out there who, video games is only one aspect of what they study. Like they'll look at broader contexts and other subjects. And throughout their career, I imagine they may move amongst various different topics.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I don't want to keep you much longer. This is a lot of really interesting stuff, and it's interesting to hear it described and talked about in such concrete terms. So I very much appreciate that. So a couple of questions to kind of wrap things up. First one is, have you been playing any games lately? Have you had any time to do that?
I did. I was on vacation in Corsica.
Nice.
A couple of weeks back. And that kind of, caused me to pick up Crusader Kings 2 again, play as the Nation of Corsica. And I did that for 2 weeks, and then I basically put it back on the shelf.
Yeah, I've never played any of those games, but from what I understand, they're very deep and you can and lose a lot good. Of time. Yeah.
Yeah. They're pretty good. I did that. I used to play a lot of Team Fortress, but my regulars have all gone to Overwatch.
Yep.
And I haven't brought myself to buy it yet, but.
Oh, it's good. You should buy it.
I think I'm going to do it.
Yeah. You should play it. Send me your friend request on Battle.net. I'll hook you up.
Okay.
It's good. And it is an easy transition from TF2 to the Overwatch because it's the same bones, you know, same basic kind of game, but it's just newer and more polished, and Blizzard is really good at making video games. It turns out. They have a lot of things figured out.
So yeah, I guess I'll be playing that in the foreseeable future.
Yeah. It's good. I've been playing a lot of Overwatch myself. It's sort of my, you know, I've got 30 minutes to spare, you know, I'll play a couple of matches, couple of rounds.
Yeah.
But I've also been playing, Just Cause 3, which is like an open world, action game, where you blow up a lot of stuff and
I played Just Cause 2. Yeah. So I guess it's not very different from that one.
Nope. It's Just Cause 2 with like more stuff to blow up and new toys and on the new platform on the, playing it on the PS4. So I'm enjoying that quite a lot. So if somebody wanted to find out more about you and your research, where would they go on the internet to do that?
Well, I have a website.
It's very cool. It's got like a Pac-Man motif. And...
Yeah. So I have that website people can go to. Maybe you can put a link on your podcast.
I absolutely will,
if anybody's interested. I also have a Twitter account, but fair warning, I don't tweet a lot about video games anymore. Mm-hmm. It's more about psychological research methods in a much more abstract way. But people can definitely get a good impression of what I'm doing now there.
Okay. I'll put links to both of those up in the blog post and the podcast notes that go with this episode. Well, thanks for coming on. It's a lot of really great stuff.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, thanks. Hey, you made it. You're here at the end of the podcast. Nice. I hope you enjoyed it. I enjoyed having that discussion. So make sure to go to psychologyofgames.com, where you can find out how to subscribe to the website and subscribe to the podcast and follow or contact me on various social media. And the other thing you ought to do is go check out patreon.com/POG so that you can help support me and make sure that other episodes of the podcast are forthcoming. Speaking of which, in the next episode, I'm going to have a really cool conversation about motivations behind playing video games. Why do we like to play games? And some of the most well-established research about gaming motivations. Plus, we'll get into a little bit about how that applies to No Man's Sky and a few other different games. It's going to be cool. I'll see you then.